This is Blue Moon. It's the original fan-made Manchester City podcast. Coming up, we've got news and views from City's Week. It's your club, and this is your show.
So back to business at Anfield, as once again it proves to be City's kryptonite, with the team unable to build on their one win there in nearly 20 years. But there are definitely questions raised from the game that we can get into on this week's Blue Moon podcast. Was Pep Guardiola right to tinker with the setup for this occasion, or would the team have been better attempting to play in a more familiar way? We'll put that along with questions about the goals, the one that was allowed and the one that wasn't, and all of the fallout from the game to this week's panel shortly. It's also time for City to get back in the saddle. It's Brighton at the Etihad on Saturday in the Premier League, and then there's a Champions League group to win. Avoid defeat against Borussia Dortmund on Tuesday, and Pep Guardiola will be sure of finishing the table in top spot. All of that to come, so let's meet our guests for today's show. I'm David Mooney. I'm joined by the man behind statcity.co.uk, Adam Carter.
Hello.
And the BBC's football correspondent, John Murray.
Hello.
John, good to have you back on. It's been a while. How have you been?
Yes, there's a lot of water passed under the bridge, hasn't there, since we last spoke, but I think City are in a stronger place now, aren't they, than they were when we last spoke, which is saying something.
Yeah, all going well. Adam, it's been been a while since you've been. I think maybe earlier in the season, first one of the season, second one of the season, something like that. So it's how are you doing?
Yeah, second show, but I'm still coming down from the fire pit that was the Anfield game. So hopefully we'll dissect that and you can provide some cathartic for me.
Yeah. Right. Well, to start with this week, I'm going to do something a little bit different. Regular listeners will know that my views on various aspects of football kind of seep into these podcasts from time to time. And as much as I do like the sound of my own voice, I do try not to dominate discussions with my own views. But this week, I think it's a little bit different. I want to talk about the fallout from the game at Anfield. It's been a week where things have, well, they've basically got too much. We'll talk about the football and Pep Guardiola's tactical setup and the goal that wasn't and the goal that was shortly. But first, I want to address what happened off the pitch. You already know what this is about, because reports of unsavoury chants about Hillsborough and Heysel, and reports of coin throwing at the manager, and reports of a coach being damaged again, they've all been dominant in the last few days. I do want to stress at this point, though, that this isn't a blame game. I don't care who started what. I do care, though, that it doesn't carry on. Football should be a place that isn't sanitised, where we all kind of stay silent and clap politely when a goal's scored. Nobody wants that. But equally, I want it to be a place where we can all feel safe, where I can feel safe, and where you can go and enjoy your team, or not, as Sunday was for City fans, without being put at risk physically or verbally. City against Liverpool has provided some of the best games in Premier League history. With the size of the game comes a responsibility, and that falls on everyone. It falls on the clubs and their press departments. It falls on the managers, on players, on fans, on people who work in sports media, on podcasters as well. The narrative can get pretty toxic, and it has this last week. I don't think you can be surprised that if you create a tinderbox, you get sparks. It's not long ago that there was an opinion piece that this rivalry wasn't a real one because there was no needle. And now we're in a situation where everyone is disgusted with each other because it's all gone too far. You'll read plenty of opinion pieces in the run-up to and the aftermath of these games designed to rile you up. You'll see it on TV, you'll hear it on the radio. Don't rise to it. Instead, engage with what is the responsible coverage, of which I very much hope that the Blue Moon podcast and the people that we have on it, that's what they do. So, if you're one of the fans that sang about Hillsborough or Heysel, please, please, please have a think about what you're doing. There are survivors and relatives of those who died in that crowd who should be able to go to games without being reminded of it and put through it all again. Remember the 2008 Manchester Derby at Old Trafford. There was a genuine fear there that City fans would ruin that 50th anniversary memorial of the Munich air disaster. And in the end, we were all thanked for being impeccable. And that was a pride thing. It was a badge of honour afterwards. In 2014, when these two teams were battling for a title in a previous era, City went to Anfield on the Hillsborough anniversary weekend. Fans held up a banner in the away end with a City badge that read Justice for the 96. How far away from all of that are we this weekend? Now, I also know it's unlikely that they'll be listening to us, but if you are one of those fans who threw coins at Guardiola or attacked the City bus as it left Anfield again, please have a think about what you're doing. No rivalry is worth hurting somebody with actions like that. Everything needs calming down, and we can all play a part in that happening. Football, as I say, shouldn't be sanitised or we'll lose the excitement and the drama, but equally, we can't live in a world where just anything goes. goes. It's time for us all to be better, and it all starts with looking at ourselves. We can't control what other people do, but we can control what we do, and we can play our own part in de-escalating things. So with all of that said, John, I'm very much aware that I'm preaching to the converted with most of what I'm saying, and I'm also aware that when you're in Anfield at the weekend, you're focusing on what's happening on the pitch because you've got a job to do. But what was your experience of it all? What did you make of what happened at Anfield?
Well, I think that with this, there's an awful lot that's been all thrown in the pot together. And as you've said, to use that phrase, there is an awful lot to unpack from this game. But there are a lot of different aspects to it. But when you're talking about the basic point of decent behaviour, you know, I think that's what you are focusing on first and foremost and primarily there. And, you know, something that always does baffle me and, you know, I can't quite understand it really because, you know, in this country, we've got an awful lot in common, haven't we? And when you boil it down to certain areas of this country, if you're talking about the northwest of England, then people from and who live in and are, you know, have sympathies and loyalties to the northwest of England have an awful lot in common, don't they?
Yeah, yeah.
And yet, football can create these divisions. But I think what people have got to remember, you know, putting aside all the arguments about where the football clubs are, what it is that Jurgen Klopp said or didn't say, what he's accused of, what he's not. You know, when you talk about basic human behavior, that is at the top of the pile. And, you know, are you behaving in the right way? I think that's what any individual has to ask themselves when these moments arise. And, you know, it's a very simple question. And I think we know that a lot of what happened at Anfield on Sunday was people behaving badly and crossing the line into unacceptable behaviour.
Yeah. Adam, for you, as a fan in all of this, does it feel too toxic right now? Does it feel everything does need to be just kind of calmed down?
Yeah, like John alluded to there, it's crossed the line. I think this is a game that I now no longer look forward to. Just because of the toxicity of it, just because of the tinderbox that it becomes, just because of the pressure that's almost this is if we really need to go back to basics and boil down that we watch football for enjoyment. The tribalism, because it is more than just watching an entertainment product, it does seep into your day-to-day life as well. But we need to not lose sight of what we're there to do. We're there to watch 22 men entertain us for the hour and a half to allow us to escape from our day-to-day lives. And I find myself not looking forward to the Liverpool games because the pressure is so much. And not even for what happens on the pitch. It's more that the things that envelop it around it, the build-up on with fans on Twitter, the articles that are generated from fanzines, from the songs that are sang in the stands. And I'm all for atmosphere, and we can create some great atmospheres without having to cross that line. And I find myself now just dreading the Liverpool games because of what it's become. And it was absolutely abhorrent, the songs that were being sung and the coins being thrown and whatnot. But my question is, were those songs sang before the kind of it spilled over on the pitch as well, or is that kind of a fuel to the fire? And just because we need to not lose sight of when something bad goes on the pitch, we can't just turn into absolute animals off the pitch just because we're perceived to be hard done by. And the same, I don't think people were throwing coins at Pep before he was kind of gestating to the crowd with his kind of orchestrating his conductor arms. But, you know, I just think we can't lose sight of it just because of something that goes against us on the pitch. It's just abhorrent.
We were always going to get to this point, David, I think, with the rivalry between Liverpool and Manchester City. And it wasn't such a long time ago that I remember covering these matches and people would say, and I would get asked the question, well, it's not really the rivalry like Manchester United and Arsenal had all those years ago. It's not really like the rivalry that Liverpool and Manchester United had. It's not really like the rivalry that Manchester United and Chelsea had. But the simple fact is, that if you've got two clubs that are as powerful as they are over a period of time, then they end up playing each other a lot more than they would do normally, more than just two league games a season. There's lots more to it. Therefore, that familiarity does breed contempt. Yeah. It's no excuse to say, as I've been suggested, that, well, Jurgen Klopp whipped it up with what he said in his pre-match press conference. I mean, do me a favour. You know, he's giving his opinion on questions that he is asked. And if you can't respect someone else's opinion and behave properly when it comes to it, you know, there is, as I say, there is a line that people shouldn't cross. And that is the first thing that you have to remember.
Yeah. Well, as you alluded to, things did change on the disallowed goal. The atmosphere did ramp up at that point. So let's get into the incidents from the game. And let's start with that turning point, because I think City were, they were kind of controlling things up to that point. Here's what Pep Guardiola said about the disallowed goal afterwards.
Well, this is Anfield. This is Anfield. The referee spoke with my assistant coach Rodo and Jurgen, said, okay, I'm not going to make faults and it will be clear. And all that game was play on and play on and play on and play on, except the goal, because we scored after, it's not play on. The referee can decide, I'm going to whistle all the actions, but he decided on do it, and after he did it. We didn't lose the game for that, because nobody knows what would happen, but it was a moment that we have in our momentum and we control and score a goal and could not do it. And after, we lost by a mistake.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast.
Now, John, you can see his point about soft fouls not being penalised until the goal, but ultimately there is a very clear foul in there, isn't there?
There is a very clear foul, and you know that all the club, whatever was said, you know, I know what has been talked about, what was said by Anthony Taylor before the match. At the start of the season, this was made very, very clear to us that the referees were going to have a higher bar. And as soon as you do that, then there's, you know, there's another grey area there, because the bar is higher, but where is the bar? And if you don't allow the play to flow, then the officials are going to be criticised for being too pernickety and breaking up the play. I generally, as football fans, I think people would rather see the game flow in the way that it did. And, you know, the simple fact of the matter is, it was, in my opinion, it was a foul. It was a foul that was picked up by VAR. It was the right decision to disallow the goal.
Yeah, Adam, there is the kind of knock-on effect where it's unfortunate, because, as John says, I agree. You can't ignore that when it's been referred. But equally, like, it does have the effect of it does swing the momentum, and it's not City's fault. It's not Liverpool's fault. It's something you have to deal with, though, isn't it?
Yeah, so absolutely, it was a foul first and foremost. And let me know if I contradict myself here. I'm a big fan of the bar being high. I think Anthony Taylor had a good game up until that point, in that he was letting everything go. So I'm happy if you let everything go, you continue to let everything go. And I prefer the game as a spectacle because of that. Now, once you let you, because that was definitely a foul, Haaland on Fabinho, I think it was, but there was other fouls during the game that didn't get penalised because they didn't result in a goal. So you're only ever going to look back at these events if it leads to a goal. If it leads to a corner or a throw-in, it never gets reviewed. So in those instances, the best you can hope for is that you get a corner rather than go and score a goal, and you get penalised for those fouls. The ridiculous foul that Bernardo did on Salah that he let go was almost worse than the Haaland one, yet he's letting that go because it didn't result in anything that was, you know, could be penalised thereafter. So it's just, and like you say, it's not the team's fault, that the resulting action is then whether it's looked at or not. And that's just the only gripe for me. But I'm not here to say that it wasn't a foul.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that, and my second point on the bar being that high, if the referee on the pitch is having a bar that's high, the VAR needs to have the same size, the same bar at the same height as well, because as soon as he deems it as a foul that we're not going to let go, then it becomes two different decision makers making two different decisions.
Yeah, but it's an issue maybe here, John, that is the VAR protocol, because ultimately the protocol is that Anthony Taylor describes what he's seen to the VAR official, and the VAR official will go, well, yes, that matches what I do. Don't review it. What I see, don't review it. No, that doesn't quite match what I see. Come and have a look at it. And ultimately, the only way that doesn't get referred is if Anthony Taylor says, yes, I saw Haaland pull Fabinho's shirt, so he clearly didn't. At that point, then it has to be reviewed, and you get the overturn. And that's kind of where you get the inconsistency with those other incidents that Adam's talking about, I guess.
Well, I find it so interesting as a broadcaster that, you know, we do occasionally get to hear these things and you get to hear the conversation. And certainly if I cover a game for Match of the Day, for example, I can actually listen to what's being said while I'm doing the commentary. So you've got a very, very good idea about what is going on. And I do genuinely feel that we will get to a point somewhere down the line where this is released, you know, maybe at the time one day, but certainly in the aftermath. And I think it is genuinely full. And I spotted this when I was watching Match of the Day when I got home on Sunday night, in that Guy Mowbray, who was commentating for Match of the Day, made the point that, first of all, VAR were going to look at the foul, the Fabinho-Haaland foul, and then they would have actually looked at Haaland's challenge on Al as well. And I'm not sure that that would have survived VAR either. So it's that communication thing again. But with the referees, with VAR, we're in a position now where we're kind of in no man's land between the current regime and the new regime, which will come in during the course of this season. And we have to hope that when Howard Webb's regime takes over, that we do see a very quick and clear improvement in what's happening on the field, and also I think the communication off the field. But it's still a long path that we're on here. Don't be under any illusions.
Yeah, Adam, just finally on the disallowed goal, how much of that turned the game in Liverpool's favour? Was it City not responding to having that goal disallowed that ultimately won Liverpool the game?
Yeah, the age-old thing that I say about disallowed goals is it's almost as if the other team have scored a goal because they've had the, you know, deflation of thinking they've conceded, and then the elation of actually they're back in the game and they get to cheer. They get to cheer us not scoring, which is a new phenomenon in the VAR age. And that galvanised them a bit. And then we kind of felt hard done by. It looked as if, I mean, you'd still expect 11 professional players to be able to get their head back in the game and switch on, but that wasn't the case. I think it went a bit scrappier, because up to that point we were almost containing them. I didn't really feel under too much pressure as a City fan that I usually would at Anfield. I think we were well in the game, and then we just kind of lost our composure. It felt like maybe it was me feeling hard done by and aggrieved, and then that kind of just, you know, blinded my way of viewing the game. But certainly we looked a little bit scrappy thereafter.
Such a fine line, though. It was such a fine line. I mean, that game could easily have gone the other way. And again, it was another illustration of, despite, you know, Liverpool's in and out form this season, that when it came to the crunch there, we did see the Liverpool that we've seen when they've been at their best in recent seasons, and it demonstrated how little there is between them.
You can listen to the show ad-free by joining our Patreon, patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Let's touch on the goal that was allowed. With 15 minutes to go, Alisson collected a Kevin De Bruyne free kick, and within moments, the ball was at Mo Salah's feet and then in City's net. John Guardiola called it a mistake there, but I think there's several mistakes, isn't there? De Bruyne could put a better ball in. He then doesn't track the run, and then basically Cancelo gambles against Salah and loses. And at that point, you know, you've already had a warning shot across the bows from Salah. You can't survive two of those, can you?
It's a big gamble as well, isn't it, by Joao Cancelo? If you do what he did there, you've got to make it. And actually, having been at Anfield since for the West Ham game, Salah very nearly did the same thing in that match as well. You know, he is a master of doing that, being able to turn and roll and beat what is effectively the last man high up the field. So that was the crucial moment.
Yeah, Adam. Just on a technical point, should Cancelo be left 1v1 against Salah at the back, especially after like Diaz slipped what 20 minutes earlier and let Salah in? It's like you've had a warning here, boys. Maybe you should cover this a bit more.
Yeah, there was definitely the warning shot that we should have acted on. I think Walker's injury has led to a bit of the last line of defence looking different. If Walker's fit, I know it's coulda, woulda, shoulda, but he'd be there and you'd back him for pace, and he'd really give us, you know, he'd give us a bit more security going forward, because we know if there is a quick turnover, he's likely to win a foot race. But I don't know how quickly we could have reacted or should have reacted to Cancelo getting it done about, like you say, 5, 10, 15 minutes before that. And then it happened again, a carbon copy. So I'm not a big fan of Cancelo being our last man in defence. I think it's he's a great defender. Well, he's better going forward than defending, but he's still a great player and he should have read it a bit better. But in that atmosphere against Salah, when he's looking to turn you, I wouldn't back many defenders to come out on top. So I think it was just the omission of Walker via his injury rather than a poor tactical choice on the day. I don't know how quickly you can react to that.
Yeah, well, let's touch on the tactical choices as well, because since he seemed a lot more conservative for this game than previously, there was a change of shape, and it seemed to be a bit more in a bid to control Liverpool. Adam, you said that you were quite happy with how City had controlled the game. What about Guardiola's approach, though? Because did it in a time when Liverpool were feeling a little bit nervous about the game and were feeling a little bit nervous about themselves, did it show them too much respect?
Absolutely. So we know Pep is petrified of Anfield and the Liverpool aura. We've seen it in these Amazon documentaries where before we even play Liverpool, I think it's the Everton game, he's talking about how we're going to control the Anfield, the game Anfield and things like that. So we know Pep's petrified. We know it's his kryptonite. And the form that Liverpool were in, we should have almost gone for the jugular. John mentions there that once Liverpool do have to step up, they do show that they've still got that quality. So they're by no means these meek minnows that we would have torn apart, but we were in the ascendancy and they were somewhat questioning where they were at in the season. I was happy with the lineup at the beginning, but I didn't realise that it would mean that De Bruyne was wide right, and that is not where I want KDB. You want him in the centre. I know why he did it, because he wanted Bernardo in the middle channels, like doing all his running, which he is so effective against Liverpool at doing. But I thought our lineup was okay because we had opportunity to change it during the game, but that didn't happen. And any time you put De Bruyne a wide right, for me, you lose his efficiency in the final third of the pitch.
Yeah, but on the flip side, John, as you said earlier on, if that 90 minutes ends in a draw or it ends in a City win, I don't think people come away from it saying that it was an undeserved result. So it was a tight game decided by the narrowest of narrow margins.
Still a strange one, though, I felt, but it's not somewhere that we've not been before, is it, with Pep Guardiola, when for a match of some standing, there are surprises in the lineup or the formation or whatever it happens to be. And yes, you know, the Anfield thing, and I know the Liverpool people, you'll have heard it as well. You know, there's so much talk, isn't there, that when City went and won at Anfield 4-1, season before last, you know, when Liverpool were in that slump they had that season, you know, it is always mentioned from the Liverpool side that was an Anfield which didn't have a crowd. It was behind closed doors. And similarly as well, that slump that season when they lost the 6 consecutive home league games, there's always that caveat. Yes, that happened during the behind closed doors days, and very often actually they will refer back to the last time that Liverpool were beaten when there was a crowd at Anfield, which was quite some time ago now. So yeah, it's in there. That, you know, that has to be considered to be a factor, and coupled with how Guardiola was post match with the using that phrase, "This is Anfield."
Yeah, it certainly plays on his mind. Now, before we move on, we had a question this week from Steve O'Brien on the emails concerning what Jurgen Klopp had said in his pre-match press conference about competing with City. That sentiment has also been part of the tensions this week between the two clubs. So I sat down with One Football's Dan Burke and City fan Harry Stopes to examine everything that's been said.
I think it is true that City can outspend anyone if they want to. Certainly, probably anyone in the Premier League, maybe only PSG can sort of compete with them globally, but The sort of counterpoint to that question is, well, how many transfers do City actually get wrong? You know, if you look at just the Guardiola era, which seems to be the line in the sand that's being drawn at the moment, you think about Benjamin Mendy's been a big flop that hasn't properly been replaced. You know, people talk about the fullbacks an awful lot and they lump them all in together and they say, oh, they signed Walker, they signed Mendy, they signed Danilo, they signed Cancelo. And it's like, well, Cancelo came in and Danilo went out. So that was a bit of a net spend job there, wasn't it? And aside from that, there aren't too many big money transfers that City have got wrong. And there is a science to that. You know, they've invested a lot in the scouting network as well. They're the kind of numbers that don't get put on the graphics on Twitter when people are talking about spend, you know, that kind of spend that goes on behind the scenes, and all clubs are doing that kind of thing. And City have also walked away from a fair amount of transfers because the numbers got out of hand and they couldn't make it work. Like, ask yourself, why have they done that? If they can, you know, if they have the unlimited spending, if they have the deepest pockets in the world, why do they sometimes walk away from transfers? And the reason is financial fair play, which has been enforced, you know, when City have fallen foul of that. You know, we went to the Court of Arbitration for Sport and that was all sorted out, you would think, but people still have their theories about that and their conspiracy theories, and fair enough, like maybe we would have conspiracy theories if it involved another club, but at the end of the day, that cast verdict is pretty set in stone, so there's kind of no complaints that can be had about that, I don't think, anymore. So I think, you know, obviously we know that City have a lot of money and they've spent a lot of money, but they are bound by the same regulations as everybody else.
Yeah, Harry, I mean, that point on bad transfers, that like other clubs have spent similar amounts to City in recent years, but they have spent it badly. That has some merit in this, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I was just going to add as well, not to be like spreadsheet about it, but when you actually think about it from an accounting point of view, the money that a club spends on a transfer is actually averaged out over the period of time that the player signs the contract for, which is, let's say, for the sake of argument, 5 years. So if you spend an additional 10 million, that's 2 million per year. So the fees that City are spending on someone like Kyle Walker, which was deemed at the time to be astronomical, I remember Jonathan Wilson writing an article about it in The Guardian, which included a reference to the Dutch tulip craze, which he'd obviously just read about and thought he was the only person that ever discovered this very well-known event in financial history. But anyway, yeah, that was deemed like a ridiculous sum, but he's been around for 5 years-ish, I think, and it's been an outstanding signing and hasn't needed to be replaced, apart from obviously occasionally when he's been injured. So as Dan said, yeah, I mean, City have signed, generally speaking, they've been very wise in the transfer market. I mean, in general on City spending, it is very near the top of the Premier League. If it's not the highest, I'd have to double check the figures. I mean, City do spend among the highest on transfers, and they spend among the highest on wages. In fact, the highest on wages. And that's one of the reasons why they're the best team in the league. I mean, there is a correlation. City do spend a lot of money, and there's a correlation in terms of the results on the pitch.
The other thing as well is that the net spend is improving recently, right? The last couple of years, the net spend has been really good, particularly this summer. City sold loads of players and ended up with a negative or positive net spend. I'm not sure how you put it, but...
Profit. They ended profit,
there we go. Yeah. Because City are now at that point in the project, for want of a better word, you know, it's been a long time coming, but where the outlay doesn't have to be so significant all the time, where they can still go big for the occasional player here, but we're generating much more saleable assets from the academy than we ever have before. You know, the CFG has been a really good money spinner, like it or not. It's been a great idea and a bit of a revolutionary idea in football, the kind of stuff that other clubs have been... lauded for in the past for the way that they've conducted their business. So, you know, whether you like it or not, I think you have to say that the CFG has been a great thing for City in terms of the finances that it's brought in. So that's why we're seeing this kind of leveling out in terms of the net spend now. And I don't think it's going to be such a huge outlay for City in future.
Yeah, I want to come to net spend shortly, but first let's just play this. This discussion has come about because of what Jurgen Klopp said to the media ahead of Sunday's game. So let's hear directly from the horse's mouth what he was saying.
Nobody can compete with City in that. You have the best team in the world and you put in the best striker on the market. No matter what it costs, you just do it. I know, City, they will not like it, nobody will like it, you ask a question, but you know the answer. But what does Liverpool mean? We cannot act like them. It's not possible. There are three clubs in world football who can do what they want financially. It's illegal and everything fine, but they can do what they want. Put in, and they will say, "Yeah, but we have." But it's exactly the fact we have to look at. We need here, we need that, and we need that, and then we have to look here and make it younger, and here a prospect, and here a talent. That's what you have to do. And you compete with them. It's not a problem at all for me. It's like it is, but it's you don't ask me that question, because we always open this discussion, and in the end, it's me telling you. But you all know it. You should know. It's not possible to deal with that, and it will be like this. I heard now the Newcastle, whatever is there, said there's no ceiling for this club. Yeah, right. He tells you he's right. He's absolutely right. There's no ceiling for Newcastle. Congratulations. Some other clubs have ceilings.
So, Harry, what do you make of what he says?
I mean, I think he's deliberately misinterpreted the remark about ceiling. Just as a side note, I think the guy from Newcastle was clearly saying there's no limit to our ambition.
Yeah.
But that's a separate point. I mean, it's a moot point, really. The important question is, well, what does he mean by compete? Because they can compete on the pitch. They just did on Sunday. They were within a point of winning the league last season. And you know, one good game or one bad game away from winning the Champions League as well. And over the last 5 years, they've tended to run City very close. I mean, it looks, if you like, it's sort of, it looks like it's very skewed towards City because we've won 4 out of the last 5 titles. But they've, with the exception of, was it, I have to remember now, 2021, it was all very close, apart from the one that Liverpool won, which was very not close in their favour. So they can compete on the pitch, certainly. I mean, I appreciate the conversation is a bit more subtle and complicated than that, but on that simple level of the pitch, which is what football is ultimately all about, what he's saying simply isn't true.
I mean, the exception that I would take mostly with Klopp's comment is that I'm not sure that Liverpool's ceiling is actually lower than City's. And if it is, I think that's through choice. I think they probably do have the capacity to spend more money if their owners wanted to invest more money, but they don't seem to want to do that. They do often just spend the money that they earn. And that's, you know, their own issue, really. That's not City's fault. And I do wonder if maybe Klopp was trying to send a bit of a message to FSG with that as well, while also having a bit of a dig at City of kind of saying, like, look, if you want me to properly compete with this club, then you're going to have to put some more money in. But you know, I think you have to say that Liverpool, they have done very, very well, especially while Klopp has been there, on a tighter budget than City. I don't think it's a low budget. I don't think that's fair to say, because they've spent a lot more than a lot of other clubs.
I was going to say, there'll be plenty of other clubs who look up at Liverpool from the league table and go, what are you on about? We can't compete with you.
Yeah, and it's very much a first world problem, isn't it? And I think it comes down to good scouting and good coaching at Liverpool. And, you know, you have to say fair play to them from that, for what they've achieved during the time that Klopp has been there. But then you look at the players that they've actually brought in, the players available to them compared to the players available to City. And there isn't much between the two squads, you know, as they are very keen to point out. They have, you know, a lot of world-class brilliant players, and Klopp himself has even pointed that out in the past few months, that they've got the best goalkeeper in the world, the best defence in the world and all this kind of thing. And arguably, they have a deeper squad than City. I think they've probably got more senior players than City have. That was certainly the case last season. They've had a few bargains along the way that they've picked up, like Andy Robertson. They've had some academy players come through, like Alexander Arnold. But most of the signings in that squad are sort of £30 to £80 million players. Like, it's good, but it's hardly a fairy tale achieved on a shoestring budget. And that is kind of what Liverpool are very conveniently sort of positioned themselves and how they would like us to see them, I think. But it's not really accurate.
I think my other issue with this as well, Harry, comes in again from the net spend argument, with that there is one transfer that does skew a lot of this discussion, and it's that Liverpool sold Coutinho for a lot of money. City haven't done that really until this summer.
No, it's true. I mean, I think I broadly share Dan's opinion on most of what he just said. I would slightly push back a little bit in that I think that Liverpool have been running on fumes a little bit in terms of their squad, maybe in the last couple of years. I think that they're approaching a quite significant overhaul. Salah's 29, 30, something like that. Mane's obviously recently gone. There are valuable squad players like Milner, who, you know, to be fair, had a very good game on Sunday, who are, you know, he's approaching the grand old age of being the same age as I am. And you know, will need to be replaced. So, and the other thing to say is that over the last five years to 2021, which I think is the last accounts that were available, this is based on figures from Swiss Ramble, the guy who does sort of football finance. If you combine amortization, which is basically the amount that clubs spend on transfers averaged out over a contract, if you combine amortization and wages, City are spending about 18% more than Liverpool. So there is more resources behind City. 18% is a decent wedge. So Liverpool are overperforming in a way compared to, let's say, United and Chelsea, who are underperforming. So I think he's got a little bit of a point, Klopp, I mean. But as Dan said, I think his gripe is with FSG, or should be. Because I think that the way that they choose to run the club is somewhat similar to the Glazers, actually. It's not as bad in terms of the amount of money that they take out, but I think the model is quite similar.
Get your ears around our bonus episodes every Monday. patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
I mean, at this point, I would like to talk a little bit about the ownership as well, because if the problem is when people view City is the source of the money, and we can talk about, you know, different sources of money until the cows come home. But ultimately, if it's a rich owner, a sugar daddy, a benefactor, does that cause inconsistencies with kind of how United or Liverpool or Chelsea initially became successful years and years and years ago? Because nobody's really doubting that their organic growth, as they all like to call it, came from sustained success in various different periods. But that success was often brought about initially by a rich benefactor or by clubs spending beyond their means. Take United, for instance. You know, late 80s, they spent a lot of money to get themselves in a position to start winning the title quite regularly through the 90s, at a point where the title then became really, really profitable to win. So isn't a scenario with clubs like City, like PSG, like Newcastle, just the kind of the next logical step in that sequence, Harry?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think that... So firstly, I mean, clubs like United were obviously the greatest benefactors, but there's also Arsenal, Liverpool to somewhat lesser degree. You know, the clubs that happen to be near the top of the pyramid and have, you know, big names and history and so on, quote unquote history, at the time that huge amounts of money started coming into football, we're in a sort of lucky position that for the first time you could make massive, massive sums and therefore spend massive, massive sums in a way that wasn't possible previously. And it's to a certain extent, a kind of a fortune combined with, obviously, United had a great manager at the time in the 90s and so on, whose name I forget.
we don't say it around here. It's okay.
No. It's verboten. Yeah, I mean, I think City's model has basically been to just sort of artificially accelerate that process of putting money in and getting money out just over a very short period of time. But that kind of happened, yeah, as you say, organically for those other clubs. So the other thing that I was going to say is that I think David Kahn, who's, I know a lot of City fans don't like, and I'm not going to talk about what he said about City in the past, but he has written interesting stuff about finance in football more generally. And he takes it back to the early 80s, I think it's 1981 or thereabouts, when Spurs became the first club to become a PLC, a publicly listed company. And at that time, the FA could have basically prevented Spurs from doing that, because they were the regulator of football. And they could have said, no, PLCs can't play in a football league. But they didn't do that. They sort of were asleep at the wheel. The regulator, if you want to call the Football League and the Football Association, regulators of the game, they just never did anything. You know that. And so, as you say, where we are now and where we may be in the future with, you know, the dreams of Todd Bowley and all that is kind of just the latest step.
Yeah. I mean, the other point about all this, Dan, I'm interested in is that it's at this point when you have this discussion with opposition fans, the conversation often turns to sports washing. And if that's the issue, is that a completely different discussion? It's not about how much money City has spent, but it's about who owns the club, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is a completely different discussion, not to sort of put it to one side and say we're not talking about that, like, you know, pull the wool over people's eyes or anything like that. I just think it is a different discussion. I think, you know, it's definitely something that requires examination. And I've never been comfortable with the association with Abu Dhabi. You know, I resent the fact that we are asked to, as fans, to answer for, you know, human rights abuses that go on thousands of miles away. And I'm at the point now where I completely accept that there are some fans who just don't want to engage with that at all and just want to kind of enjoy the football. And I think that is a legitimate position, that people can just ignore it if they want to, and they don't have to, you know, give up supporting the club or things like that. You can just, if you don't want to engage with it, then fine. I've also thought that for a while that maybe the sports washing angle has been a bit overplayed and is perhaps not as fundamental as people would like to have us believe. You know, there is a world where City's owners, whatever you think of them, are probably just rich people who are running a business to turn a profit, as it's their big portfolio of businesses in the same way that they do. And I think the sports washing conversation has become just completely toxified now. The word is used so often and bandied around so often that it's essentially lost all meaning. And, you know, I know that the response to what happened at Anfield at the weekend from City. Apparently they've sort of been briefing behind the scenes that there may be a bit of xenophobia at play there, and I don't think that's very fair, really. But I do think there is something going on when it comes to the way people separate so-called good money from so-called bad money. To me, it's all just a different flavour of capitalism, really. But there is this, you know, whenever someone says state-funded or state-backed, it's almost a bit of a dog whistle at this point. And I think that requires a bit more examination as well as how we sort of view that part of the world and money that comes from that part of the world.
Yeah. Is it fair to suggest that City are the problem, Harry, rather than part of a wider systemic problem when it comes to spending? I mean, almost in the sense that City are a symptom of the problem rather than the problem itself.
City are definitely, in my view, in it, although it pains me to say it as a City fan, City are a symptom of a wider problem. You know, I wouldn't want to admit that, but it is the case in terms of the way that money has played a role in football. And the way that one, you know, your experience as a fan and the amount of respect and priority that's given to fans has eroded over a long period of time. The first part of that question is true. City are a symptom of a problem. But again, the problem is wider. As I mentioned earlier, it's got a very long history. And the people who are responsible for regulating the game, both in the UK or both in England and, you know, at the European level and at the world level. I mean, if you look at UEFA and FIFA, they're not organisations that are opposed to corruption. I'm sure we can say that, you know, without having to legal that part out of the conversation. And so there isn't necessarily the appetite to really get to the bottom of it. And I mean, the CAS case, the case that was heard at CAS and then the verdict at CAS is a sort of I don't fully understand exactly what that means, that the various, you know, the allegations were time barred or the evidence was time barred. I feel like it's a bit murkier than some City fans would imagine, but it is the apparatus that exists to regulate sport. And sport across the world, in many sports, not just football, is awash with money, and it isn't always very well regulated.
Yeah.
And that is the field, to use a sporting metaphor, that City are playing on.
Yeah. Just finally as well, Dan, because I think back to me and you have talked a lot on the podcast about growing up and our experience of City growing up. I do think City fans can offer quite a unique perspective on having been on both sides of the "this isn't competitive" fence, because I quite clearly remember being a teenager watching City in the noughties and seeing a lot of situations where I was like, well, City are never going to get beyond this point because they're never going to be able to have the tools to compete with United or Chelsea or Arsenal at the time. And then the tool is, oh, you have to be taken over by a rich owner. Now, we can talk about the sustainability of that sort of model, but I just wonder if City fans should be able to kind of relate to those criticisms a bit more than maybe other fans can.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, I think I certainly remember when Chelsea were taken over, thinking that was awful, and oh, isn't it wrong that they're buying titles and how horrible? And then, you know, when it happened to us, we loved it, didn't we? But you know, I think if we had never been taken over and someone like Everton had been taken over, I dare say we'd be complaining about the same things and would have a completely different perspective on things. Like, my perspective at this point is just that this to me is, I don't know how temporary it is, but everything is temporary. And I'm enjoying the football on display from City, not guilt-free, because I don't enjoy anything guilt-free anymore. I don't think you can in this world. I think everything is, you know, there's something wrong with everything. There's something rotten at the core of everything, isn't there? And you just, amen, as a good citizen, you just try and do your best to sort of toe a good moral path. And, you know, I won't have Liverpool or Man United fans or Chelsea fans or Arsenal fans browbeating us about this all the time, because I think this is football's problem and we all are complicit in this in some way. So it's a roundabout way of saying, like, yeah, I do care and I do feel guilty about it, but I still enjoy the football. I can kind of compartmentalise those two things.
Yeah. I wonder, Harry, if this is the point, though, because it's always been a case of tough luck. This is the system, and this is the system everyone else is happy with. And like, that's always been the case, and everyone's always been happy with it when they were winning. United fans were happy with it when they were winning, and Chelsea fans were happy with it when they were winning. And only when they're not is when they start to want a change.
Yeah, and I mean the fans that really have a sort of a stronger moral case to make are not the fans of the other big rich clubs. It's the fans of not just the lower down teams in the Premier League, but it's the fans of like Macclesfield, Bury, etc. You know, clubs that have just ceased to exist or have had to reform in a new form in lower leagues because of the way that football is running, because of the way that football clubs, which are part of our national heritage and part of our history and part of what it means to be a Mancunian or a Boltonian or whatever the adjective is for Bury, those clubs have been allowed to disappear, and that is also a product of the sort of rotten way that football's run in terms of money. And it is a much, much bigger picture than who gets to win the Premier League. Much as, as Dan said, it is great to watch City and I do enjoy it. And I do compartmentalise to a certain extent my concerns about the role that money plays in the game. But if we're serious about this discussion, then it has to be conducted in a way that's not partisan. And it's about the whole football, the whole game of football and the whole pyramid of football. Otherwise, the accusations of self-interestedness are very legitimate.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
That was Dan Burke and Harry Stopes. Time now to look ahead to City's coming games with Brighton and Borussia Dortmund. John, I'm expecting you've seen a little bit more of Brighton than I have this season, but they seem to be pretty handy this year.
Not seen them yet under De Zerbi, and they seem to have referred to type a little, in terms of how they were when Graham Potter was still finding his way. But I saw them early in the season, and they were outstanding, absolutely outstanding. And they are, I think, one of the classic examples that we have around at the moment. And Brentford are another case in point where, through good club management, good club husbandry, you might call it, and good football management, and also time, you get clubs that are in that middle rank, that middle section of the Premier League, who are way below in terms of the financial resources and the playing resources of the teams above them. But because of those two things, how the club is run and how the team is run, that they are quite formidable opponents. And Brighton, even with the change, I think still have a lot of those elements.
Yeah, Adam, I can't remember off the top of my head many easy games against Brighton, and I'm kind of wondering if that's for the best. Having come off the back of what happened at Anfield, City want a game where the opposition are going to come and play, which Brighton will do, and they want a game that won't be easy.
Yeah, we've never had it too easy against Brighton. They're certainly not whipping boys, despite I think we've scored four on a couple of occasions against them. But they've also done us at their ground as well. So, and that lives in recent memory. So we won't take it easy. And I think we do need a challenge. I think the home crowd for us will help. I think there'll be an element of, a scorned animal or whatever the saying would be around, a wounded animal.
We'll love a scorned. Yeah. You can't have both, can you?
I'll have them. How about, anyway, the wounded animal effect, I think. And we very rarely, if we lose under Pep, lose again or play badly again. I always, and this will be famous last words, but the first thing I said to my friend when the full-time whistle went Anfield, I said, I feel sorry for Brighton on Saturday, because Pep usually gets his team in order after a bad defeat or a big impact defeat. And we usually go on a run and then get our ducks in a row and plough on from there. So I'm expecting that this weekend, but it's not going to be any easy. That's not going to be a reflection on how Brighton are. I think it's just a way that when Pep loses, he whips his boys, and the next week the real City turn up.
By the way, just on that as well, I feel that things are really going Arsenal's way at the moment, and if there's a bit of luck around, they're getting quite a bit of it. And I think one thing was the fact that they have not had to play Manchester City this midweek because of the rescheduled Europa League game. I think this would have been the wrong time for Arsenal to have to play Manchester City, but they haven't had to play them.
Yeah. It's funny enough, though. I'm the opposite view. I'm very happy that that game was pushed to later in the season. City could have a week ahead of this Brighton game just to kind of mull over what happened at Anfield.
There is that, but I wouldn't want to be playing Manchester City next match after Anfield. That is for sure. And one other thing on Brighton as well is that I just noticed this week the team that they played against Nottingham Forest on Tuesday night, that was exactly the same team that started their first match of the season. So another thing with Brighton is that there is that continuity. I think by and large, whether it's Graham Potter or De Zerbi, they know what their best team is. And of course, they don't have those European commitments. And therefore there is that settled nature to a team, which actually is quite a rarity these days at the top end of the Premier League.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. But don't worry, it'll be over soon.
I also think, John, that I've long had them down as the unluckiest team in the Premier League with how they seem to... They're like City in that they seem to get the ball into all these dangerous areas, but then, unlike City, they don't seem to put it in the net.
But they've got some smashing players as well. And actually, they've sold some very good players. And even with selling the players, you know, whether it's Bissouma or Cucurella, you know, they've still been able to just slot someone else there, whether it's Caicedo or Trossard, who I think is one of the... I don't think it's fair to call him underrated because I think everyone now knows how good he is.
Yeah, but
he is
straight in my player. Fantasy team.
Yeah, well, and I'll be surprised if he doesn't pitch up. You know, if he's not maybe the next big sale that Brighton make. And one other thing that really jumped out at me this week is that people might not have picked up on is the fact that for how well Danny Welbeck plays for Brighton, he's actually not scored for them yet this season.
There you have it, Adam. Ex-United player coming to the Etihad.
Yeah, first goal scorer. Yeah, I'll put my money on it. Thanks, John.
Yeah. Adam, all of Brighton's games seem to be really tight affairs. So, I mean, for City, how do you calm the nerves in the stands? Because I do know from having been in the Etihad enough times when it's a tight game, you know, we can get nervous in the stands, can't we?
Yeah, an early goal, please, and not a Danny Welbeck goal. That would really calm the nerves. We just need to control the game from the off. I think Brighton are more than capable of imposing themselves on the game when they've got the ball, so we need to make sure that doesn't happen. We need De Bruyne in the right position. I think the players will be up for it. I think we just need to turn up, play our game, and it will be enough. That's not to discredit Brighton at all. I just think we need to stay on the ball early, maybe an early goal, and then it should take care of itself. But the longer it goes on, we know what the Etihad can get like, because we're natively pessimistic, aren't we, as a fan base?
Yeah, God forbid it be goalless on 70 minutes. Who knows what would happen there. On to Borussia Dortmund then, John, as well. City are already through the group, but do you think it's important these days to still win the group? The new seeding system of the Champions League over the last few years seems to have levelled the playing field a little bit. And I'm not really sure there's as much of an advantage as there used to be by finishing top these days.
No, I've seen it work both ways in terms of if you win your group, you can really end up scuppered with the draw. And similarly, you know, there can be doom and gloom. Well, they've not been able to win the group and they end up with one of the more favourable draws. You know, you're still going to have a pretty decent team to play in the last 16. But I think by and large, yes, you do want to win. You are more likely to get a more favourable draw if you win the group.
Yeah. So with that in mind, Adam, how do you balance this week for Guardiola? Because obviously with already being through, you kind of want to be a bit more sure of the Premier League points, don't you?
Yeah, and... but Pep's always got this thing about rhythm and momentum and keep giving players minutes who need minutes in the league. He likes to play De Bruyne a lot to keep him in the rhythm. So I don't think we'll see an absolute, you know, 11 changes. There's still the element and the prestige of winning the group. It's a statement thing. And like we say, whoever doesn't win this group, there's a second place team in Dortmund or City that other winning teams aren't going to want to face. So it's the seeding system's a bit strange now that you're going to have two good teams regardless, you would think. So I don't think there's going to be the element of, oh, we must win this game to win the group. That might affect Pep's thinking when we play Sevilla. But I don't think it's going to be wholesale changes, but there'll certainly be a smattering of one or two that'll come in. But he likes to keep the momentum. He likes to keep the rhythm in players' legs. So it won't be wholesale, that's for sure.
And I think when Manchester City do eventually win the Champions League, which they will, what they want to do in the season they win it, I think, because it's quite a rare feat, is to win it without losing a match at all in the Champions League that season.
That could be this year then. Set the sights high. The other side of this, Adam, we always talk about youth players and youth prospects coming through at City and opportunities. The Champions League group stages, when you are already through, I get that it's a difficult environment to blood youngsters into. But there are players who are on the fringes, who are not quite senior players, but not youth players anymore. I'm thinking the likes of Cole Palmer, for instance. Is that the sort of name that you can see coming in for this game? Or is it still a very much a case of that's the sort of name that would come off the bench?
Yeah, I still think they're coming off the bench type names. I'd personally play Cole Palmer from the off, you know, as soon as possible, but it's not my job on the line if that goes wrong. So Pep is very much putting players on the pitch that are going to do the job for him first and foremost. But me, I've got the romance of seeing the City Academy and seeing youngsters like Phil Foden coming through and, you know, representing our club at the top level. And I want that more and more. So I'm always biased when I'm asked questions about should we be playing youngsters more and more. I think the Dortmund game will have more of a reflection on what the Sevilla team looks like based on the result of Dortmund. And if we're through and we've topped the group or perceived to have topped the group thereafter, I think that will open the door for players like Rico Lewis, Cole Palmer, Wilson Esbrand to maybe get a start. But I still think Pep loves the rhythm and the momentum too much to really, you know, throw 11 new players at it.
Yeah, and I mean, ultimately, John, the game after this as well, it's a kind of 10 days or so away yet, but it's still a trip to Leicester the following Saturday lunchtime. Rhythm is important, I guess, for Guardiola in making sure that he's got, you know, players in the right frame of mind for each of these games.
Yeah, although that's never too much of a problem, is it, for Manchester City? But I think I don't think Palmer's started yet, has he, this season? And obviously had the injury problems last season. And I think Foden has not started the last three Champions League games. So, you know, that's, I think he's probably weighing up that as well. You know, not that England is top of his list of priorities by a long stretch, but obviously the fitness and the condition of each individual player is. And while that World Cup is getting closer, maybe he will feel that he has to use more some of the players that will not be involved in the World Cup, i.e. some of the younger players who he feels are good enough and able to be in the starting lineup, i.e. Palmer.
Yeah, and Erling Haaland, who will be going to Qatar. So that's a frightening prospect for all of City's opponents between now and mid-November. Right, so it's charity bet time. We've raised £205 so far on the charity bet this season. We each get a £10 correct score single on City's games from William Hill, and the winnings are going to the Man City Fans Food Bank Support Group. They're helping the Trussell Trust collect food and money to support Manchester Central Food Bank. If you're at the game on Saturday, then go and drop them a visit with a donation if you can. They'll be under the bridge by Asda between 12:30 and 2:30 p.m. So let's kick off with the Brighton game. John, what are you having for this one?
I am going to go 3-0 to Manchester City for that one.
3-0 is 13-2 and £65 if you're right. Adam, what are you having?
3-1 City.
3-1 City is 10-1 and £100 if you're right. I'll go 4-1 City, which is 14-1 and 140. That brings us on to Dortmund. Adam, what are you saying for this one?
1-1.
1-1, 7-1 and £70. I've gone for a City to edge it 2-1. That's 8-1 and £80. John?
And I'm going for a classic Champions League-style later group scoreline of 2-2.
2-2, if it comes in, is 14-1. It'll win City the group, so no need to feel bad about that. And it's £140 for the charity, if you're right as well. You've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. Please gamble responsibly. And for more information, take a look at begambleaware.org. Now, we're going to finish with a quick listener question this week. Get in touch for next week on Twitter, at Blue Moon Podcast. You can email us through the website as well, bluemoonpodcast.com. Alan's got in touch on the emails to say, I went into this season thinking that City were very light in the fullback area. area with only Cancelo, Walker and Gomez as options. I was pretty happy with the summer signings, but I was worried that we'd swapped being short of a striker for being short of defenders, especially in the fullbacks. 10 games in, and sure, there was a little wobble at Anfield, but I've completely changed my mind. I love the flexibility of a Kanji or Ake to fullback if it releases Cancelo to move forward, and we end up with a back three instead. Do you think that this is Guardiola's most complete City squad, even allowing for the quality going forward in the 100-point season with Sane, Sterling, either side of Aguero? Adam, you've experienced all of the Guardiola-era squads. Is this one the strongest?
Yeah, I think it's strongest in terms of age. I think it's strongest in terms of contract length. I think it's strongest in terms of positions filled as well. I always say the five centre-backs that we've got now, you could play any two of them in a starting lineup and I wouldn't bat an eyelid. We're not playing at Anfield every week, so Akanji or Ake being in what you would perceive to be less natural positions out wide at either full-back position isn't going to be an issue 9 times out of 10. So the back line's really strong now. Walker's injury, we've only really felt it because we played at Anfield away. Any other game, we've got through quite comfortably. The contract length really pleases me with the stuff that the club are doing off the pitch. That's been highlighted with the recent Club of the Year award. So, you know, the off-the-pitch stuff in terms of supporting Guardiola with what he needs. We've given him the best striker in world football, arguably, currently, in Haaland, up top. We've got width options. The fact that we were able to allow Jesus and Sterling to go because we've got Mahrez, Grealish, Foden, Bernardo, who can fill those points as well. We've got depth in the midfield, barring injuries, with Phillips, Gundogan and Rodri. I realise I'm just really
naming the team
Alvarez
now, yeah.
To support. Yeah, Alvarez to support. So what I'm getting at is Alvarez to support Haaland if he needs any rest. So certainly we cannot be complaining about injuries or squad depth. I think in recent years, it's been perceived that we've had this amazing squad depth. And while we absolutely can't complain this season, we really can't. I think I'm really happy with where it's at. And we'll have no excuses if weird things like VAR don't disrupt us too much. It won't be anything else.
Yeah. John, it's interesting that when you consider kind of where City are at this season, it does feel really unbalanced at the back. But then when you watch Ake or Akanji move to fullback and City end up with a back three, they look really balanced, don't they?
Which, of course, John Stones can do as well and has done. I think in terms of the overall squad strength and depth, it does still really strike me how many youngsters there are on the bench for City every time I see them. So I'd maybe say, in fact, it's possibly one or two people, of full proper experience, you know, proper standing, short of
senior level.
Of what City have had in the past, but I think Haaland trumps everything. And what my interest is actually at the moment is, you know, touch wood, nothing happens to Haaland, because certainly as a neutral observer, I want to see him play all season for Manchester City. If for whatever reason he can't play for Manchester City, how easy will it be for City to then drop back and refer to the type that we've seen over the course of the last couple of seasons? Maybe it won't be. Maybe it'll be dead easy for them to do that. But we'll only find that out if and when that would happen.
Yeah, John, I've also had conversations with other neutrals kind of this season who, I don't know if you agree with this, but they've kind of said they found City a little bit dull to watch in years gone by because they had to be quite methodical about how they got the ball to the six-yard box to kind of create the tap-in. And now with Haaland, there's a little bit of an element of chaos in there, and it makes it a little bit more exciting if you're not a City fan to watch it all.
I think I wouldn't agree with that about how they were, with the exception that, and I think what people are referring to there are those games where City are 2-3, 4-0 up, and they're just trying to do the same thing, and they're just trying to play their way through, and the team that they're playing against has got no ambition because they're 2-3, 4-0 down and don't want it to get any worse. So I think that perhaps is the reason for that particular argument. You know, how you can not admire and love watching a football team that has some of the talented players that City have and have had in it and what they're capable of doing, when they're on song. Does surprise me, really. But certainly Haaland now does add I was exhilarated by watching Manchester City do what they did to Manchester United in the first half of the Derby match. I was absolutely blown away by that, by the way that they played and how they took the game to opponents like Manchester United in the way that they did. And I simply just want to see more of that this season.
Yeah, amen to that, Adam.
Definitely, I'll sign up to that.
Yeah, just finally, Adam, we're talking about this possibly being Guardiola's strongest squad. So two very, very quick questions, and I realise this is an incredibly unfair way to end the show. but if you're Pep Guardiola in the last year of your contract with all this going on, you must be thinking about whether you want to put that signature down for a little bit longer.
With every passing week, I can't believe the signature's not on the paper, to be honest. Everything just seems geared towards it. We've given you the best footballer on the planet in current form, and you're still no closer to signing it, so it's got to be soon. Every time I turn on the news, I'm expecting to see a Guardiola contract extension, but it's just not happening, bizarrely.
Yeah, and how much do you think City can win this year, bearing in mind we talk about that 100-point season as one of the most extraordinary that we've ever seen. If this squad is better, how far can it go?
Yeah, oh well, see, I'd have to put my money where my mouth is there with me saying it's the best squad and we should achieve everything. I think the Liverpool game was a kind of a bit of a down-to-earth moment in that I've been preaching this season that if we don't need to be perfect because we've got Haaland, we'll still win. And Anfield was one of those games where we needed to be perfect to change it from what was looking like a 0-0 to a 1-0 in our favour. So having said that, there's no excuse and no reason why we shouldn't go to the latter stages of every competition that we're in, and a couple of trophies would be a nice little return on the end of this season, because it's going to be a weird one with the World Cup in the middle as well. I think a lot will depend on any injuries that lead into that and come from that as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. Right, well, that brings us to an end for this week's Blue Moon podcast. Thank you very much to my guests, to John Murray.
Thank you, David.
And to Adam Carter.
Cheers.
There's a clip of this week's Patreon show coming up shortly. I'll be back again next week after the games with Brighton and Dortmund. See you then.
That was the Blue Moon podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
I think my first ever game was Norwich at home in the FA Cup in about 2005 or 6. And that was just a dead rubber. And no one was particularly bothered about it, to be honest with you. But you could sense there was something different with this one. And we're on this stage now. You know, we might not have come away with it this time, but look at the level of entertainment we've got now. And, you know, rather than just, you know, milling around in mid-table for most of the mid-2000s, we got somewhere now. And, you know, we've got to this level where we wanted to be.
You're not old enough to remember Main Road and what Main Road was like. But I wonder if for a lot of fans, this is the game that they sense that the City of Manchester Stadium became home for the first time. It like there was an identity to the ground and to the stadium then that didn't exist in those earlier years at what became the Etihad.
My stepdad, who's been a City fan since the 70s, I think he was quite cautious of moving and what leaving Main Road would mean for City. And, you know, just the atmosphere in the place, it was electric. And I think that served us well in going forward and bringing a bit of excitement to the City of Manchester Stadium, because I'd just seen a couple of turbulent years of mediocrity, really.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast, and join us again next time for another episode.